So this afternoon I wanted to connect this practice of equanimity with something more deeply that our minds and hearts have been very naturally sinking into. The practice we've been doing is not only about developing a balance view and a balanced stance of our relationship with the world, but also as we've been doing the practice, you've been able to listen more deeply and hopefully with more heartfelt balance to what's going on inside, to what we're actually feeling very near and dear to us. The ability to listen more deeply, to see more deeply into the nature of reality is a very important factor in liberation. So this talk is about the river of change and how it connects to equanimity. Probably like many of you who have read the book by Hermann Hesse, Siddhartha, it greatly affected my life when I read it. It was one of the first books that pointed me towards the teachings of the Buddha, towards the Dharma. I don't remember a lot of the book, but what I do remember was about the part on listening deeply to the river, the always moving, always changing river. And that, in a way, even though it was just a simple book, not very thick, that, in a way, said so much to me. It was volumes of understanding to me about really listening to how things are always changing. Really taking that in with my eyes and my ears and my heart. The flowing onness of life, the river of life. So it began to have an effect on me even in my teens, like probably many of you, with other things that might have opened you to the Dharma. The river of life with all of its changing experiences. And at first it was about looking outward on all those experiences, seeing not just nature change, but how people grew old, how there was death, and seeing in myself the experiences of pleasure and pain and praise and blame, and not putting them into those eight vicissitudes, but really just knowing that that's all a fact of life. And little did I know that all along this time, and touching those experiences, just letting my heart touch those experiences over and over and over again, without flinching, it was developing, of course, that ability to be more mindful and that ability to develop more balance around it. Because the more we allow ourselves to be exposed to something that's painful, the more we're able to kind of develop that balance within us so that we can open to it, we can experience it with a little more ease of well-being. And sometimes as we see, the river of change is melodiously and gently rippling by. It's very easy to be at ease with it. And the danger here is that we're so at ease with it that we want it to stay. We get attached to it. We don't want it to leave. We want to create more and more of that. Nothing's wrong with that. But when we're doing it as a great big pattern in our lives, closing everything else off, not being able to open to the painful experiences of life, then this becomes the great challenge. And sometimes the current is strong. Whirlpools of confusion, of doubt, of hatred, of resentment can overwhelm us. Unpleasant experiences. We're not at ease with this. The natural thing to do for survival in most cases is to close down. But then we tend to sometimes strike out, or we tend to run away and avoid when we can actually use our energy to open to it. We all know this. It's quite a trite saying to say to ourselves or others, everything changes at every level, the outer world and the inner world. And I think meditation really helps us to have the courage and the strength and all the tools we need to open to that inner world in a way that we can see the truth of life more and more deeply. So this afternoon, I want to talk about seeing impermanence in a deeper way, which requires us to have a lot of equanimity, so we can realize the preciousness of using our lives for not just helping in the world, but deepening our wisdom so that we can help in the world in a more powerful way, a way that really helps people. The Pali word, Pali is the language that the original teachings of the Buddha were translated in. It's also translated in Sanskrit and in Chinese, but Pali's just one of the ways. The word for impermanence is anicca, anicca. And one of our colleagues and elders calls this word not just impermanence, but inconstant. When we look at the word permanence, we tend to think as about something as being more solid, and that's true too. Nothing is solid. Even scientists have looked into matter and seen that even with one molecule or one atom, it's mostly space. There's hardly any matter there. When we look at the word impermanent, we might think of something permanent, like solid. But when we look at the word inconstant, we have more of a connotation like something is coming and going all the time. There is an arising and passing away of every moment. Everything is inconstant. Something of that same nature may come up again, but it's not the exact same thing that already arose and passed away. I remember one time, one of my most difficult retreats was when there was a lot of dukkha in the body, but it was really one of the most transformative retreats of my life. And I went to the teacher, Upandita, at that time, and I said, will I experience this again? Thinking that because I experienced this, I won't have to experience it ever again. I already went through the dukkha, you know. And so he said, no. I went to the next retreat, and it was worse. But there was a lot more strength of equanimity. There was a lot more mindfulness in the next retreat. And so there was more strength to face it. But then I went to him, and I said, you told me that I would never have to experience this again. You know, do you have an answer for this? And he said, I didn't say that last part, but I said, you told me I wouldn't have to experience this again. And he said, it's not the same experience. We may think it's the same, you know, because it feels the same, because we call pain, pain. We call the body, the body. But it's always changing. The sound that we're hearing now has never been heard before. It will never be heard again. Everything is inconstant. It's always changing. It's always different. The possibility and power of experiencing and understanding this anicca at the most profound levels comes in large support of equanimity. And that's why it's so vitally important to do this practice. It comes naturally it's developed naturally with mindfulness, but we can deepen it with our practice of equanimity in the Brahma Viharas. being able to open to incessant change takes a lot of the strength of equanimity, having that stability, having that steadfastness, and having the spaciousness to be able to open to everything, outwardly and inwardly. Vipassana, the practice that many of us do, I guess most of the time in our meditation, which is greatly supported by equanimity. This vipassana means seeing or understanding in profound ways. Seeing or understanding in profound ways. The aim of vipassana is not simply just to be present, just to be mindful. That's very much on the surface. Really, mindfulness and just being present is a good beginning. It's a very powerful thing that is onward leading, but it's not enough. Through that practice, if we keep a continuity of it and we do, we bring in the practices of like loving kindness and equanimity, we're able to see more deeply into the nature of reality, seeing in profound ways. So what do we see in profound ways? One of the first things that we see when we drop in deeper into our practice is the experience of this uncontrollable impermanence, this uncontrollable inconstancy of everything. Not just at a level of seeing that it might be sunny now and it might be cloudy later, it's light now, it's darker later, the seasons change, people are born and then they die. Not even at that level, but it's at a mind-boggling moment-to-moment level of seeing constant change. It's the deepening into the truth, the possibility for that of that for us is being presented to us when we go deeply into our practice, moment by moment by moment. It's as if it's showing us, this has arisen, now it's passed away. Nothing lasts forever. Can't you see this? If you're able to see this very, very deeply, we don't hold on so tightly. This anicca, this understanding of impermanence at very, very deep levels, opens us to the fact of dukkha, the first noble truth which has been translated sometimes in an unfortunate way. The unfortunate translation is life is suffering. Well, that's true, but it's not all suffering as human beings know it. The true translation of that first noble truth, which is dukkha saccha. Dukkha means suffering. Saccha means the truth. There is the truth of suffering. That's what it means. There is the truth of suffering. I think all of us can agree upon that. Unless you're really in denial, you wouldn't understand that. There is this fact of suffering. There is this truth of dukkha, that when we see anicca deeply, we understand dukkha. We begin to understand dukkha also very deeply. So what does that mean more precisely? The truth of dukkha, the first noble truth. It means that there is no ultimate or lasting or permanent satisfaction in any situation, in any person, in any condition, or in anything. We want to believe that it's otherwise, but it's not true. People die, we're separated from those we love. Situations arise and pass away according to conditions. Things, physical things, get old, they break, they get replaced by newer versions. There's no lasting satisfaction. So I think the word lasting or permanent satisfaction is a good one to kind of be more precise about that. Of course there is satisfaction in our lives, but if you look deeply and more honestly, even that feeling of satisfaction isn't always there. Manindra used to say to people who would come to Bodh Gaya to meditate and then complain that there were no nice cushions like we have here. You know, he would say, even if you were sitting or reclining on a soft cloud, eventually you would feel dukkha in the body. There is no complete satisfaction anywhere. And so we see that through the understanding of impermanence, this inconstancy of everything. When we see that deeply, of course, when there's happiness, it's enjoyed. There's nothing against enjoying happiness. But then we understand that it's not to be clung to. Because if we cling to that happiness, that's always going to give us some lasting happiness, or it's always going to be this way, it's not going to happen. That only causes suffering. So it's this attachment to what we think is the cause of our satisfaction or our happiness, the attachment to it that causes suffering. Another deep understanding that we come to, a profound understanding through anicca really, through impermanence, through seeing the evanescence of all of life, is that we see how insolid it is. And that everything that exists, even a moment of experiencing the body, when it's seen really deeply, there's nothing solid or there's no core to anything in the body. There's no core anything to touch, to hold on to say, this is self, this is me, this is mine, this is who I am. Because even that is uncontrollable. It's arising, that experience is arising and passing away in every moment. So we begin to understand life through the practices that we're doing, and especially the practice of Vipassana, aided greatly by equanimity. We begin to see underneath the conceptual level of life. We begin to see more deeply how impermanence is going on all the time, how dukkha is happening all the time. Even things somebody said to me this afternoon, the realization that even the pleasant experiences pass away. This is dukkha. Even something that's pleasant passes away. So it's not the occasional awareness that realizes this, that pierces into the truth of life, but it's the continuous, ever-increasing high quality of our practice that is able to pierce into this illusion of seeing everything solid, of having a sense that we can grasp onto something that will give us lasting happiness, of feeling and thinking that there is some kind of even permanent self to turn to and to say, this is lasting. Equanimity is so powerful here because when we have enough strength of equanimity, we're able to open to these deep truths that sometimes can be very scary. We don't want to hear sometimes these things. We don't want to open to them, because they can bring new understandings to us that break old understandings that have been giving us some kind of security, but maybe false security for a long, long time. The basis of the teachings in the Dharma, or the Buddha's teachings, are these. Our efforts to control what is uncontrollable cannot yield happiness. We cling to what cannot last forever, and that yields unhappiness. And this is what where our suffering comes from, clinging to what cannot last forever. And by engaging in this delusive quest, we bring suffering to ourselves and others. We keep looking for what's stable in an unchanging, in a changing world, in a world that's not the same. It's like when people say, and we know, that no snowflake is like any other. Well, no moment in this life of this big world, of this big universe, is like any other moment. When we begin to see that so deeply and clearly, more and more our hearts live in alignment with that. And we stop fighting that truth. We stop resisting that truth at deeper and deeper levels of our being. And we start living in alignment with that. So when things change, it's how it goes. Things change. I mean, we can say it so tritely, but do we really live it? When people die, when people age or get sick, or a loved one we're separated from, or something dear to us is lost, can we just shrug our shoulders and say things change? Of course, it hurts our hearts. But when we look at our hearts and how that's working, it's giving us these signals and these truths all the time. Even the heart is changing. Even the relationship to what's happening on the outer level is changing. There is no constancy anywhere. It's giving us this truth over and over and over again. The understanding of impermanence is so powerful, they say, that in the teachings of the Buddha he has said, though with a faithful heart one takes refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, or with a faithful heart one observes the rules of living in harmony, the rules of sila, or develops a mind full of loving kindness, of metta, by far more meritorious it is if one cultivates the perception of impermanence, even if only for a moment. Even if only for a moment. But that moment comes because of the cultivation of that impermanence from previous moments, when we're able, with a lot of balance of mind, to look at it over and over and over again, to look at our heart's response to what happens over and over and over again. This moment, it's not like it changed my whole heart and uprooted greed, hatred, and delusion permanently from my heart. But I remember this moment in my own practice, that I've been going along hearing these teachings from my teachers about impermanence, looking more deeply at levels of my heart that were hard to look at. And one moment just... It was when I was doing walking meditation. It was on Maui, and Manindra was the teacher of that retreat. And I was walking back and forth on this very kind of graveled path. It was a driveway, one way, going back. And there was a very light wind in the air. There was a red hibiscus bush that I would walk past all the time. And once in a while, I would see the flowers on the bush. And then there was one moment when I saw one flower move in the wind, fall down. It was withering, come off its stem, and drop to the ground. And though that moment, which was brought on by many previous moments of watching impermanence, but not really saying this is impermanence, it's just by knowing how things change all the time, that moment was transformative in my life. Actually, it brought up so much fear. It brought up the whole thing about things, because hibiscus flowers live a day only. It brought up the whole thing about death. It opens in a day, and then it dies in that day. this whole thing about death and this whole thing about the just change. It was more the movement than it was the dropping and the falling away, the withering and decaying. It was more just that movement. I went to Manindraji very, very quickly, and I told him how afraid I was about knowing this. And he was very kind and very equanimous with me, so it's kind of catchy, and you're able to just open to it yourself. This moment can come at any time by the continuity of our practice, by the ability to be with what's difficult and face what's sometimes so painful in our lives, but we can face it. Many more moments of opening to change came after that, but that was the first kind of scary moment for me. One of our teachers calls this the beginning point of truly realizing the Four Noble Truths: the noble truth of suffering, the noble truth of the cause of suffering, the noble truth of the end of suffering, and the fourth noble truth is the noble truth of the way to the end of suffering, which is the Eightfold Noble Path. So this noble understanding of realizing the noble truths brings us to a place of genuine refuge, because we start living in alignment with the truths that are so hard to bear, instead of resisting, instead of fighting them, instead of wanting it to be otherwise. Some of you know, because you've heard me talk about this before, some of you have practiced with Sayadaws. Sayadaws are teachers in Burma, and or with Sayadaw Upandita. But when we report to the teacher, we not only report what is being noticed, but we must report, if we forget, he asks us, what happened to what was noticed? Or he may ask us, how did it pass away? How did it dissolve? How did it go away? Because we report what arose and what was being seen. But what was important, and the teacher was always pointing out, was did you actually notice the passing away of it? And we have to, you have to look closely to do that. It makes you, because you know they're going to ask you very specific questions, it makes you look really closely. So you have to report, you know, that maybe it fell off, it fell away like if things fall off a cliff, or maybe it exploded into it. Sometimes it does, it kind of just explodes into different pieces. Sometimes it just dissolves really slowly. Sometimes it kind of just changes like the edges of a cloud. And just reporting all the different ways that things change, that things wither and die and pass away, it instills in your heart that experiential knowledge of that. It's important to be aware of that in our practice. And we incline our practice there over and over again. Even in equanimity practice, we use the words praise and blame arise and pass away, in pointing out this anicca, pointing out this change all the time. It doesn't last. It doesn't last. Nothing lasts. Just the bare experience and the knowing of it doesn't last either. It takes a keen mind to know that. Sometimes we have an idea that even that knowing is permanent, but when we look closely, we see that knowing arises with what is to be known, and when what is to be known dissolves, that knowing also dissolves. So even that is fleeting. A lot of what keeps us from not realizing the fleeting nature of everything is that we make a story around it. And I know here in equanimity practice, we encourage you to reflect, and because we're doing that kind of practice, we're reflecting on what's going on in conditions out there, what's happening here, and that's okay. But when we use equanimity with vipassana practice, we want to just be able to be spacious and balanced around what's happening. we don't have to reflect so much on everything. In Vipassana practice, we want to be careful not to make stories around what we feel or what's going on. Because when those stories drop, we are able to see how things are more ephemeral. In a way, when we make stories about something, it makes it all more solid. It kind of creates a solid experience and also a solid sense of self having that experience. This is a beautiful quote by Carlos Castaneda. Whenever the internal dialogue stops, the world collapses. The extraordinary facets of ourselves surface, as though they had been kept heavily guarded by our words. So in our insight practice, there's something beneath the words that's pre-verbal that we begin to realize and see more deeply. So listening to the flow of the river of change over and over through the years, opening to it, seeing it happen, hearing it happen, hearing the sounds come and go over and over again, bringing that into that deep understanding of the flowing onness of life. There's a deep sense of, first there's insecurity in knowing this, but then it deepens into more security, a kind of Dharma security, that of knowing the truth of life instead of fighting it, instead of using our energy to make it otherwise, because otherwise maybe would be more easeful for us. As I've told some of you, responded to some of you, my own teachers have responded to me when I've said something like, I want to have more security for myself and my children, you know, when I was a single parent. And my teachers would say, there's no ultimate security. The security is really knowing the truth, that there is no ultimate security. And then when you can live in that, you can live then more easily. Of course, you're still going to do things to help your family eat and have shelter and be loved and cared for and protected, and you're going to help yourself do that too. But this is what we have to do for ourselves all the time in our lives. Even Manindra, you know, this is called, this is Sankara Dukkha, just having to do the whole, everything over and over and over again, you know. He used to even say, I used to say, let's go, Manindra, it's time to go now. And he says, oh, he says, Sankara Dukkha. I said, well, why? I have to brush the teeth. If I don't brush the teeth, it will get all full of whatever. And he says, then I have to bathe. You know, we have to do these things over. We have to feed ourselves. We have to go to the bathroom. All these things we have to do over. Of course we have to do them. We feel sometimes happy to do them, sometimes not. So it helped me to relax more into the understanding of the truth of that, when in different ways my teachers would say, you're not going to find that lasting happiness. And I would insist that I could, you know, I'll find the right man, not the one who's having another family somewhere else. I'll find the right job that gives me enough to do the children thing. And, you know, I'll have just the right posture in meditation so that everything unfolds without any pain in the body anywhere. That's not going to happen. Like my kids would say, wake up and smell the coffee, Mom. It's just not like you want it to be all the time. We can easily accept and see the changes in nature, in the weather patterns outwardly. Nature is our teacher, of course, expressing the continual change, teaching us over and over again. It's light. The sun is rising in the morning, and now it's getting darker. Don't hold on to that. The seasons change. There's this dance of birth and death all the time, In between, there's a lot of change. I like the way Goenka puts it. He calls dukkha decay. You know, just watching how things are decaying. In some Buddhist countries, when they put flowers on the altar, you leave the flowers there until they die. You let them get all brown and let the flowers wilt, and you don't change them because they're now unsightly, you know. It's a teaching to see the flowers die, to see the decay. In our own, my own place of Hawaii, there's lots of elders and kapunas, and sometimes we bring tea leaves to ceremonies, and they make a point of saying, don't just bring the beautiful tea leaves, bring the brown ones that have been all ripped up by the wind, because that too is part of life. So all of this preparing us for the truths of life, but do we open to all of that? Another Anicca quote by Sogyal Rinpoche: there would be no chance at all of getting to know death if it happened only once. But unfortunately, fortunately, life is nothing but a continuing dance of birth and death, a dance of change. Every time I hear the rush of a mountain stream, or waves crashing on the shore, or my own heartbeat, I hear the sound of impermanence. These changes, these small deaths, are our living links with death. They are death's pulses, death's heartbeat, prompting us to let go of all the things we cling to. The cycles of life, they're uncontrollably rolling on, uncontrollably rolling on. I mean, there's some part of us I know that finds that that we can rest in that in some way. And if we can rest in that, we can rest in any other change of life. Maybe we need that to first teach us and feel our deep resting in. There's something very comforting about that, you know, the winter turns to spring, and then spring turns to summer, and summer turns to winter again. No, to autumn. I thought I forgot one. And then to winter. And then there's this continual change. And then with every single one, no winter is the same. No spring is the same. And we can see that a lot now. The change in our environment, this climate change, can have a deep impact on us. We can notice how the relationship of our hearts to all of that climate change. Is there fear? Is there anger? Notice that. How is that changing? Is it always the same? Can we stay okay with that once in a while? So we're learning that. Can we live not just with them, taking them for granted, but also live in the wisdom of deeply knowing the wisdom of change? Deeply knowing that we can learn from this. So it's the power not just that the patterns are changing, but the power of change itself. As the Buddha said, it's one of the greatest, just in a moment, how it can change your life. And going back to what some of my students call the hibiscus moment now. It did change my life. After that, it was no stopping me. I wanted to understand more deeply. That was a time when I jumped from doing that kind of a retreat to longer, much longer retreats. And I had children, small children, and I really wanted to develop something deeper in wisdom in my own heart. So things change on a seasonal level, on a heart level, on a birth and death level. This is Another Spring by Kenneth Rexroth. The seasons revolve and the years change with no assistance or supervision. The moon, without taking thought, moves in its cycle. The sharp stars flicker in the tremulous branches. The lake is black, bottomless in the crystalline night. High in the sky, in the northern crown, it's cut in half by the dim summit of a snow peak. Here we lie entranced by the starlit river, and moments that should each last forever slide unconsciously by us like water. This is saying that we want to hold on to the beauty, but the experience of the beauty doesn't last. It gets dark, we can't see it anymore. It changes. It slides unconsciously by us, while we may be just holding on to how we want it to remain. So the seasons, experiences in our hearts, come and go. This is from Rilke's Love Poems to God, translated by Anita Barros and Joanna Macy. Let everything happen or unfold to you. Beauty and terror, just keep going. No feeling is final. Haven't we seen that that's true? We've been pointing to that over and over again, looking at how we're feeling about things out there, about people, about our relationship with the world. It may constantly come up anew, but that pixelated view of what's happening doesn't remain the same. It's always changing. And birth and death. This is from Issa, the great Japanese haiku poet, on the death of his child. Dew evaporates, and all our world is dew. So dear, so refreshing, so fleeting. It takes a wise heart to see it that way. So noticing and accepting that level of impermanence on this level of reality that's conventional reality, it's beautiful and poetic, but what's going to be really freeing for us is seeing it at deeper levels, which is what equanimity is helping us with, supporting us with. As we see the extraordinary change on a moment-to-moment level, opening to the inner weather patterns, as we have begun to do here, memories, feelings, intentions, sensations of the body, the knowing, consciousness itself, seeing it come and go over and over and over again, noticing the dissolving nature of each moment. Manindra, as I said before, would use the phrase, this is the law, this is how it is, meaning the naturalness of how things come together, form something, and then dissolve. And it's really magical when we can see how something's starting to come together to form some kind of temporary existence, and then really freeing and magical to see that it doesn't stay that way. It changes. He would say, as I said, this is how it is, surrender to the law. A lot of times I would go to him and say, this is what's going on, and this is what I notice, and this is how it passes away, but he's knowing that I'm really not letting go of how I think it should be, how I want it to be. How the sitting in the afternoon is not like the sitting in the morning. And he would say over and over, let go, let go, let go, let go. Sometimes one of my long reports of like 10 minutes is a long report. One of my long reports to him is just responded by the words, let go, let go, let go of expectations of how I think it should be. Letting go of resentment and guilt, of course, and shame. You know, haven't we all experienced wonderful sittings in one part of the day, like the morning, and then we think that's going to happen the rest of the day, And we're looking to re-experience that mourning thing. And it's so painful. We don't realize it until we just surrender to it. Like one of my yogis says, there's nothing like a good morning sitting to ruin the rest of the day. And then, you know, when you finally realize that you're you know, trying to figure out, how did I sit? What did I eat? And you're trying to replicate that. And it's not going to, it's not usually doing any good. Let go, let go, let go, let go. These are from the words of the Buddha in the Sutta Nipata. Let there be nothing behind you. Leave the future to one side and grasp not at what remains in the middle. It's like, don't hold on to anything. That's a really hard guideline to follow. But in moment-to-moment practice, that's really what we need to do in order to deepen. Of course, you know, if we're family and we're human beings, we remember our loved ones in the past. We remember good times and bad times. It's not that we completely let it go. But we don't have to create a sense of self around that. The future, the planning, we don't have to create any solidity around that, because usually it's how we think it's going to be. It never really happens exactly that way. And the most important part is not holding on to what's going on in this moment, whether it's pleasurable, not thinking that that's going to last. If it's not pleasurable, also not thinking that that's going to last. Both of those ways of thinking will get us in trouble. You know how when you have a bad sitting, what we call a bad sitting, a painful sitting, and we think, this is going to last forever. Don't we think that? We'll never get out. This is going to last forever. I better stop now and do something else. But we also think that about pleasant feelings, pleasant sittings. This is going to last forever. That's delusion speaking. But when wisdom speaks, when wisdom is present, it sees that moment. It's just this moment. It's fleeting. It's not going to last. From the Diamond Sutra, thus shall ye think of this fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning, a flickering flame, a phantom, a dream. See all compounded things being like these. So when we look deeply at the seemingly solidness of the body, what do we see really when we bring equanimity, a sense of balance to pain in the body? We see hardness and softness, contraction and expansion happening. If we're not overlaying it with a thought or the wrong idea of this is me, this is mine, this is who I am, there's simply this sense of hardness, softness, contraction, expansion sometimes. This is the earth element manifesting in its changing nature in the body. When looking at pain with mindfulness, and there is heat, warmth, coolness, coldness, varying temperatures, when there is not this overlay of a concept of self, of me, of mine, and I there, it's just the fire element changing fiery moments of temperature and the lack of temperature over and over and over again. When the body sways in sitting, or it jerks all of a sudden, or there's feeling of vibration in the body, or stiffness when the body is alertly sitting. This is the air element keeping the body erect like that. When we overlay a sense of self to that pain and that experience, that is really the second arrow. There's already pain. The first pain of just feeling that existential pain there. And the second arrow is saying, the second arrow of dukkha, of suffering, is saying, this is me, this is mine, this is who I am, and this will last forever. The water element, that binding element that binds all other elements together, is part of every other element, experiences heaviness in the body. So we see this hardness arising and passing away. We see jerking, vibration arising and passing away. Heaviness in the body. Heaviness can turn into lightness just like that. Always changing, everything always changing. Where is there in the body a place to say, this is me, this is mine, this is who I am? And you go with like that with other experiences of the mind. There was a writing by Alan Watts, and I just quickly copied it down. He said that he knew of a physicist at the University of Chicago who was rather crazy, like some scientists. Sorry if there's some scientists here. And the idea of insolidity and instability of the physical world so greatly scared him in one way that he would go around with big padded slippers. And he would think that he was going to just go through something solid all the time. I think he did it as some kind of clownish thing. But he saw how unstable and insolid everything is as a physicist. And it's like that. It's like when we put the microscope of Vipassana practice, the microscopic lens that not only sees more deeply and sees more minutely, but sees more closely and in a bigger way. What's going on beneath the surface of things? It's very different than the solid conceptual overlay that we put on life. So we end up when we are more in line with the truth of not really trying to grasp on to that solidity of security anywhere. We're allowing things to arise. Be with it when it's there. Do what we need to do with it. Enjoy it if it's something pleasant. But not need to hang on to it when it goes away. If it's unpleasant, just knowing that it's impermanent will give some relief to us. So finally, on this flowing river, we open to the change that changes us. And that is opening to death, really. The understanding of death, the fact of that change. It opens our hearts in a way that nothing else can. It opens us to the preciousness of life. It begins to transform our lives and how we relate to others. It's one of the protective reflections that the Buddha gave us. The protective reflection on death goes like this. It's very simple. I am subject to death. I have not gone beyond death. Just reflecting on that every day, even though we've seen it in others, do we remember it for ourselves? It will dispel some deep delusions that we have about it. When I was younger in the practice and not so open to this truth, I was so overly protective and fearfully protective of my children. I was protective in a way that, they fought. They didn't like my kind of smothering of them in a way. I don't think I smothered them, but I was just always watching out for them in a way that maybe that fear was a little catchy. And so the teacher that was around me a lot during that time was Aya Kema, a German woman who became a nun and had children of her own. And so when I would tell her about my stories in relationship with my children, she, like Manindra, got fed up with hearing me. I'm so happy and glad that I had teachers that got fed up with me. Because I might be really lost by now, if not for them. But she said something to me that I didn't like for a long time, and I apologize if it scares anyone. I understand that now. When I would talk to her about my children, one time she said, "Kamala, you must be able to see your children dead." I didn't want to talk to her for a long time after that. You know, that was so shocking to hear. She said, "You are not beyond death. Your children are not beyond death. It could happen any time." Well, thank goodness, you know, that they're still alive and everything's all right. But that so opened my eyes to that it changed my perspective. She also said, "This will make you stronger." And I feel that it has. You know, during that time, I was actually working in a cemetery and mortuary. I was in the administration of those places. And I talked to people all the time who were having loss in their family. And yet it was hard for me to face it for my own children, with my own children. There's a Carlos Castaneda, I read a quote from him earlier, a writer whose teacher was Don Juan. There's a story about him being at a restaurant where someone overheard him say to other people at the table, and this was in California. A small group was with him, and a woman asked the question, "I want to have a more spiritual life. What do you suggest?" That was her question. And she thought he would say something different, you know, having the experiences that he had in the desert with his shaman teacher, Don Juan, and all of the things that he went through. But he said to her, "If you want to have a more spiritual life, every morning when you wake up, you must remember that every person you see is going to die, and no one knows when." And that brings about in us, hopefully, not fear, but an understanding of the preciousness of life. When we really have that sense in ourselves and open to that understanding in ourselves, then it's sobering, not just gruesome, but it's sobering. And maybe we can face everybody with more kindness, more, you know, "Is this the last thing I want to say to this person when this person leaves the house?" So he also said something very sobering. This is Don Juan saying to Carlos Castaneda, "Death is your eternal companion. It is the hunter, and it is always to your left at an arm's length. It has always been watching, and it will always watch you until the day it taps you. How can you feel so important when you know death is stalking you? The thing to do when you're impatient is to turn to your left and ask advice from your death. An immense amount of pettiness is dropped if your death makes a gesture to you, or if you catch a glimpse of it, or if you just have the feeling that your companion is there watching you. The fact of your death is never pressed far enough. It is the only wise advisor that you have. And whenever you feel that everything is going wrong and you're about to be annihilated, turn to your death and ask if that is so. Your death will tell you that you're wrong, that nothing really matters outside its touch. Your death will tell you, 'I haven't touched you yet.' To ask death's advice is to drop the cursed pettiness that belongs to men and women that live their lives as if death won't ever tap them. Powerful statement to me. So how can we live in alignment with all these changes and this truth? And it's just by opening to them more. Life is telling us over and over again that there's change. Nothing holds on. Everything is letting go of itself. Is that what we're doing? Let go, let go, let go, let go. Let go of all the ways that have kept us in pain. Let go of all the clinging to ways that want us to make happiness, pleasure remain. Enjoy what there is to be enjoyed, the pleasure that comes along, not to hang on to it. See, everything is fleeting. And then we live a life that's really helpful to ourselves and others. So this is all about change and anicca and the heart that can open to it and really be easeful around it. Every time there's an opportunity for us to bear witness to it, I hope that we can stay with it a little longer, a little more easefully, and not turn away because it's teaching us. So I'd like to end with this story, another story. It's really a story that has a vision to it, a visual to it. And it's a very soothing visual. It's a story about the leaves will always fall. Every day or two, the open grounds and walkways of the monastery must be swept clear of the leaves that fall in every Asian season. For the large open areas, the monks will team up and with long-handled bamboo brooms extended, sweep like a dust storm, clearing all the leaves in the path. Sweeping is so satisfying. All the while, the forest continues to give its teachings. The leaves fall, the monks sweep. And yet, even while the sweeping continues and the near end of the long path is cleared, the monks can look back to the far end they have already swept and see a new scattering of leaves already starting to gather. Our lives are like the breath. Like the growing and falling leaves, says Achan Cha. When we can really understand about falling leaves, we can sweep the paths every day and have great happiness in our lives on this changing earth. So may this be so for all of us. And let's sit for a moment and just let the words dissolve.